This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. Our community manager, Arlene, continues to run the Tuesday evening after the podcast drops hangout. If you want to be a part of that, please join the Deconversion Anonymous Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/deconversion. Special thanks to Mike T for editing today's show. On to today's show. My guest today is Tom Christofiak. Tom has written an amazing book called Tempted to Believe, The Seductive Power of Claims About the Truth, quote unquote. What Tom has done here is really describe what skepticism is, why it's necessary, and how to be skeptical without being cynical and without being a jerk about it. What I think you're going to find interesting is that Tom's religious experience, although he grew up Catholic, is really about his time in the Transcendental Meditation movement and more from a New Age point of view. So what's interesting is he's bringing skepticism from that perspective, and he begins the book by asking the question, am I missing something? And the book is really the answer to that. I loved this book. This is the book that I wish that I had had when I was going through my own deconversion. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Tom, and I hope you go out and get the book, Tempted to Believe. Here is Tom Christofiak to tell his story. Tom Christofiak, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure.
Tom, you've written a book called Tempted to Believe, The Seductive Power of Claims About the Truth. And as I just mentioned to you offline, this could not be more timely. I said in previous promotion of this particular interview that if I were going to give it a subtitle, I would say it is Skepticism Without Being an Asshole.
that might have been a little bit more catchy, yeah.
And that is kind of right in the lane of what we're trying to do here on the Graceful Atheist Podcast. So, So you are incredibly welcome. So glad that you are here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
What I'd like to do is begin with, you know, your personal journey, and for lack of a better term, your spiritual journey, and what that was like, and then we'll jump into the book after that.
Okay. Yeah, let me try to boil it down as briefly as I can. I did not go through a difficult deconversion process in my life. I was raised as a standard Catholic.
Okay.
I went to Catholic schools all the way through high school, including Jesuit high school. And I, of course, absorbed all that, as you do as a child. And I more or less assumed that was just the way things were. But yeah, my leaving the church or leaving belief of that kind took place quite naturally for me. It was just the way my mind started asking questions, even when I was, I suppose, around 16. And then, strangely enough, one of the Jesuit priests, there were some liberal priests in our school. He thought it was a wise thing in what was called theology class to assign Sigmund Freud's The Future of an Illusion, which is all about Freud's idea that religious beliefs were illusory, and here's the psychological reasons why. And that really spoke to me. But in addition to that, my own thinking just about how is it that we can possibly know all this really definite stuff about the nature of the universe. So that all happened. And so it was graceful for
right.
me.
Yeah.
It was graceful both for me, and it was treated gracefully by those in my life. You know, luckily for me, I didn't have a problem with my parents, you know, freaking out that I had left the fold that they had invested in, you know, in so many different ways.
Right.
They weren't those kind of people. So I didn't have that issue. Even my teachers at school, they knew by the time of my senior year of high school, they knew where I was, but they didn't cause trouble either. So I had a graceful exit. It was easy.
Okay.
Then what happened to me is when I was in college, I started, for whatever reason, beginning to have a sense that perhaps there's something more to this reality than what the day-to-day that we're all enmeshed in. Now, whether recreational drugs had anything to do with that or whether it was just some sort of natural curiosity, I don't know. But I was interested in the possibility. And so when I heard various people in groups talking about ways to open to greater realities, I was intrigued. And I explored a few of them. But the one that got me was transcendental meditation. And the reason it got me, ultimately, in the beginning, was because they had embraced a scientific approach to verifying the benefits.
Right.
So, I mean, the kinds of benefits, let's put it this way, a scientific approach to verifying some changes that happened in people who practiced TM. You know, they certainly couldn't verify the broader claims that they may have been interested in, but they had that scientific attitude. They had done some pioneering research that was published in Science Magazine and Scientific American. And I was that hooked me. I said, okay, if I'm going to try something, this is the one. So that's what I did. I liked it. I liked the way it worked, the effects it had on me. And so I, a few years unfolded, I got seriously interested and became a trained teacher of transcendental meditation. Which, you know, this is, as people may know, this is a program or a practice that was brought out to the world by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. In the old days, I mean, some decades ago, a lot of people would recognize that name,
yes.
Maharishi. These days, not so much, probably. But, you know, he was the guru of the Beatles, et cetera. That's the way he was always talked about
right.
In the press way back then. You know, millions of people learned all around the world. Tens of thousands of people were teachers. It was a big deal. And as you can imagine, the training was done in Europe. I was in Europe anyway, pursuing my own studies. But the trainings were generally in Europe, and they would last, you know, over the course of the entire training might be 6 months or more. And so you're completely enmeshed in this world of people who are absolutely enthused, not just about the practical fruits of meditation, but about these ancillary claims that were more and more extraordinary
right.
about what the universe was about and what human life was capable of and so forth. And being enmeshed in that for 6 months and having it, you know, you naturally have a desire to do well and be part of, you know, to be a good teacher and be part of this whole thing. I naturally was drawn to at least partial acceptance of some really extraordinary things. Now, I don't think I ever became a full-on believer in the sense that many people are believers in things about some of these claims, but they certainly enticed me and made me think they were possible. And so I'll just briefly mention a couple of them. So the biggest thing that happened during the time I was doing that training was an advanced program was brought out in addition to the regular 20 minutes twice a day of meditation, which was the whole thing in the beginning. An advanced program was brought out, which was basically human levitation. The ability for the human being to fly, not just some sort of internal thing that felt like you were floating, but actually the claim was, yes, we're talking floating, flying through the air. And I was, you know, some people did it before. I decided to try it because
okay.
You go, hey, why not?
Yeah.
This would be fantastic if it was true.
It would be great. Yeah, big if true.
You know, it's a little weird to say that I would even be willing to try it because it's so outrageous. You know, it's such an outrageous claim. It flies in the face of just everything we know about physics and science. And that doesn't mean I don't rule things out as completely impossible if they fly in the face of current scientific knowledge. You know, there are things we can learn that we haven't learned yet. But this is pretty pretty far out there. So, but nevertheless, I was far enough into it to say this is worth a shot. And some people had done it that I knew before I did, a little bit before I did. And they came back with some, you know, reports that sounded like they were verifying the thing in some way. Anyway, so I jumped in and did it, and it was extraordinary. It was absolutely one of the most extraordinary things I've ever done in my life. And I think a lot of people might say the same. Just the way the body reacted to this, essentially just a mental process that was engaged. And it's something that I think would be a great subject of scientific research, exactly what is going on there, where the body does some things it's never done before in response to a mental stimulus. And so it was wild. It was incredible. It was energetic, but it wasn't flying by any means.
Right.
It wasn't levitation by any means.
Right.
A couple of years later, after I had done this and then come back and I was teaching meditation in here in the U.S., Maharishi put out the word that he wanted to gather 3,000 people. This was in Amherst, Massachusetts, to do this technique of, it's called yogic flying, together for the first time in human history, you know. And I said, okay, at that point, I was willing to entertain the possibility that, okay, it wasn't happening yet for us as individuals, but if we put 3,000 people together in one place and we're all doing it simultaneously, maybe that will be something, and something extraordinary. And as I said in the book, when I did that for the first time in that large group, I was expecting something to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, exactly what, who knows, but something really different from what had happened ever before.
Right.
And it didn't. So, you know, that's not to say there were, it's a rich internal experience. It's something that people get value out of in a number of ways by doing it. Maybe even some integration of brainwaves and mind and body and all these things have been explored. But certainly it wasn't what the claim was. It didn't happen. And of course, it hasn't happened since. So that's one thing. And then my wife and I moved to a little town in Iowa called Fairfield, Iowa, which had about 9,000 people at the time. And again, Maharishi made the call in 1983 to say, let's get 7,000 people into this little town of 9,000 and all do this together, and that will really crack the world open. It wasn't so much, oh, we're going to fly, isn't that really cool? It was more, his focus was always, what can we do as individuals that will affect the collective consciousness, is the word he would tend to use, the collective consciousness of the whole human race. Is there somewhat, and he certainly believed, apparently, that should be possible.
Right.
And originally the idea was, well, let's just get enough people to practice TM, just to meditate, and that will change the world. And then as that wasn't happening fast enough, he said, well, let's get this advanced group and let's get them together, and then we'll see what can really happen. And so we said, great, we quit our jobs. We moved down here along with 7,000 people. It was, again, a really amazing experience. And then many of those people were encouraged later to stay, to form a permanent community, to keep doing this together. And they built two large dome structures where the people would come every day and twice a day and do this. So the idea was, well, we'll keep doing this and then we will finally, you know, crack it all open. So this group here in Fairfield, that maybe about 3,000 stayed over time.
Wow.
Not the first day, but they managed to arrange their lives so that, you know, they could somehow support themselves. Some entrepreneurs came, started some businesses, brought businesses. People managed to support themselves and got rolling here and stayed. So maybe 2,000 to 3,000 at the peak were here. And there's still probably 2,000 here. And this group of people that I was now fully enmeshed in, because I'd never lived in a community of 2,000 or 3,000 people who believed a lot of very extraordinary things. I'll just mention a few in a moment. And so all the people around me that I associated with believed a raft of things. And these would be the one I already mentioned, you know, a possibility of human levitation. Another one would be the fact that certain practices, they're called yagyas in Sanskrit or in Indian lore, but these are basically just practices, performances, can influence by performing some ritualized event, chanting some stuff in Sanskrit, pouring some materials on some objects, you know, whatever the ritual was, that can eliminate problems, change the course of a person's life, a company, even a society. And of course, the idea that a large group doing something together like this would, like these practices would utterly transform human life on a collective level. And belief in astrology, it's called Jyotish. Again, the Indian version is called Jyotish, but it's essentially just astrology, that it's a perfect predictive science, and on and on. So I'm surrounded by belief in karma, you know, the fact that everything that's happening to us was because of things in past lives or current lives, and it's all highly orchestrated, and reincarnation, you go on and on. And this was the assumed coin of the realm among the people I was living with, including my wife. And I was curious about some of these things, but really not a believer in any of them.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, as the flying, it became clear that that wasn't really happening. That one drifted away, even from my consideration that it's any kind of likely event at all. So this was the origin of the book for me, of the book that I wrote, because, and my own internal exploration process, which was, why is it that I am not susceptible to these beliefs that everybody around me is holding to one extent or another, in the early days especially? Mm-hmm. And it was just a fascinating question. And it wasn't just an intellectual academic thing like, oh, I wonder why. It was also, it wasn't like I had tension about it or felt that I was horribly missing something. But I did wonder if I was missing something.
Right.
Because a lot of these people were quite admirable, quite intelligent, et cetera, accomplished. And they managed to believe these things and found some sort of benefit in their lives from believing these things, apparently. And I wasn't. And so I'm going, what am I missing here? And so I just tried to dive into that, an exploration on many, many different fronts and different levels to see, was I missing something, or were they just applying criteria about reality that I could not subscribe to due to a lack of evidence, basically. And that, you know, that's essentially what I came to and feel comfortable with. And that, to me, let me say one more thing, that a major demarcation or separation that I make in the book is between something that someone chooses to have in their life because they like the way it feels, or they just like having it in their life, and making a definite claim about something, about the universe or the world or how human life works.
Right.
A claim. So to me, a claim is something about an event that will appear in the material world. I claim that astrology will predict this in my life. Well, I want to see that prediction come true. It's a claim. Or the claim that, you know, you can levitate. We need to see the levitation. Otherwise, let's not talk about it, you know, in that term. You know, if doing a certain spiritual practice or ritual is supposed to alleviate a problem, let's see, does that actually, you know, play out? And my focus was on claims. I'm happy to have people have whatever they want in their life that makes them feel satisfied, as long as they're not bending the reality and making claims, factual claims about the nature of human life that really cannot be, not only cannot be established, but all the evidence that we do have seems to contradict it. And as the years went on here, I mean, we've been here for 39 years now.
Okay, wow. Yeah.
So it's a lifetime, you know. And during that time, many of the people, at least the people that are my closer friends, have had us not the same degree necessarily as I in this journey, but a movement in that direction. And I'm pleased and happy to report that to some small extent, at least, some of the people who have read my book have had some of that perspective solidified. And it kind of brought together some of the maybe thoughts they started having, but brought together in a more coherent way. That is, how do we want to look at this world? How do we want to evaluate claims about this world to make sure that they're valid and that they have substance?
Man, so many things I want to respond to there. A couple things to just say that one of the things I've really appreciated about the book is the humility and the kindness with which you describe some of these, in your words, off-grid claims. And there's an empathy for the human condition and the title of the book, Tempted to Believe, that we are all tempted to believe in things that may or may not have enough evidence for them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Again, very much in line with what we're trying to do here with the podcast of just, you know, we're all human beings, we're all susceptible to these things, and yet we are all after the truth. We're trying to find the truth. So I really appreciated that. One of the things I think for my listeners is going to be interesting. My listeners tend to be former evangelical Christians on some part of the spectrum from deconstruction, you know, just doubting to full-blown deconverted atheists, is that this comes at it from an orthogonal angle. Many of those evangelicals, when they were believers, would have seen transcendental meditation as evil of the devil. And so it kind of sneaks in past some of those defenses. And yet I was amazed at the parallels, right? Yeah. This is, again, the human condition. And the last thing I'll say is I also very much appreciated that you acknowledge the difference between the potential positive benefits of the experience and community versus a claim about the way the universe actually works and making a really hard, bright line between those two. So for example, if you find, you know, performing the ritual of you know, beneficial to you for your mental health, if you find meditation or any of these kind of practices beneficial, more power to that person. That's fine. It's when the person begins to claim that this is affecting the world in some way that is beyond the realm of physics, that's when we start to care about the truth.
Right. Well, that's great. And that, you know, I appreciate your noticing what you're calling the humility in the book. And that has been an advantage. I just ran into someone at the grocery store yesterday. He goes, "Tom, I love your book." And I didn't know she was reading it. And not a close friend, but someone an acquaintance. And she mentioned the same thing, that compared to what you often expect in books that are trying to deconstruct former beliefs, you often have people like Richard Dawkins would be the extreme Sure. example of someone who is often described as caustic and dismissive and so forth. And yeah, I mean, I didn't want to do that and I don't feel that. So that's cool. One thing I didn't say yet that I want to say, and I think it's germane to what you were just speaking about, is that, well, let's get into it this way, that the whole idea, the difference that you just summarized between doing something that feels beneficial or that you like to have in your life versus making a claim about how the universe actually works in observable ways, that's a bright line. Yeah, that's a clear distinction. Some people, many people, don't care about the second thing. They don't care if it can be proven, if there's evidence for it. They just clearly don't. And you go, okay, well, is that all right? Is that just another way of being? And to some extent, I want to sort of go in that direction and be, again, generous to say, well, that's the way their life is going, and those are their values. But this is the other area that was not the impetus of my book, but sort of got sprinkled in as the time went on with the rise of the rise of fake news and alternative facts and really more bizarre conspiracy theories and so forth, and the divisiveness in our political sphere. All of these things are based on beliefs, and they're based on beliefs that do not have evidence.
Right.
And these things are not a matter of, oh, well, this is someone's internal life. It's their spiritual life or whatever it is. And, we shouldn't be too concerned about what they're doing inside their own head. But when it starts to manifest, as it really seriously has, not just in America, but really around the world, when these kinds of alternate realities, not based on facts, start being treated as if they were facts, and building entire, political movements on them, we've got problems. Mm. And so this is what started to become more apparent to me, even though it wasn't part of my original impetus, that the same kinds of questions that we're talking about here, about how you evaluate what's true or not, or whether it's important that you evaluate things in a certain way as to being true or false, whether you apply the rigors of evidence and rational thinking or not, it's become a matter of really deep societal importance outside the realm of religion or New Age beliefs or the kind of things I was talking about in my background. Well outside of that sphere, as important as all those spheres are, we have another big thing on our hands, and it's completely related. Just as you said, even though my book is not talking about the typical journey that that a lot of your other guests and people have gone on, you found that it was resonant with some of those same processes. Yeah. Well, now we're having, to me, some of our greatest societal challenges outside of those realms also resonate with these same principles, which is, how much does the truth matter, and what do you mean by the truth, and how do you find the truth? And to me, the greatest challenge that we face, perhaps, is that people totally disagree about that.
Right.
What's interesting, though, is there are people who go, especially in the spiritual realm, go, I'm totally not interested in objective means of proving any of this. I have my own internal truth that I am totally solid and clear about, That's one thing where you just sort of deny the applicability of any kind of objective truth. You go, that's not relevant here to me.
Yeah,
and that's a tough issue, but that's mostly on the subjective or spiritual realm. When you get into these other societal realms where people are arguing about what's true or what isn't true, a lot of times the people who are saying really outlandish things claim to have proof.
Right.
They're not saying, oh, proof doesn't matter. This is just the way I feel. I have an intimate experience with Jesus Christ or with whatever. Don't talk to me about proving. It's irrelevant. They're saying, no, we can prove this.
Yeah.
So if you, for example, I don't want to offend any particular groups of your listeners, but it's an obvious example in our society. If Donald Trump so many of his followers are going to say the election was stolen, they don't say, I have a feeling the election was stolen, or, my spiritual guide told me the election was stolen. Right. They say it was stolen and we have evidence.
Right.
And then they bring it to court. And of course, all the courts so far have failed to agree that there was any kind of evidence. But nevertheless, the claim is made. Or a lot of conspiracy theorists will claim that they have evidence. Certainly the big one is the 9/11 truthers who, the idea that it was an inside job and it was totally put up fake thing. They'll put out reams of really impressive looking video discussions with some experts and so forth, proving that there's no way these towers came down in this way from airplanes.
Right. And
so this is what gets doubly difficult, because it's not just a matter of, do you accept evidence at all as a valid way of finding out what's true? They'll go, yes, of course we do. And we've got evidence. And then it becomes a much more difficult task of sifting through competing versions
right.
of evidence
yeah.
and say, which one of these really holds up? And the problem is that none of us, most of us, are incapable of doing all of that background evidential research or checking ourselves. And so we naturally have to ferret out which of the experts or authorities out there in the world are the ones that we have reason to think are reliable.
Right.
And then we follow those. So this gets really thorny. And that's why the only hope I see is in a greater depth of education emphasis. I don't know if this will ever be happening in our educational systems, to the process of doing exactly that. How do you weigh, how do you ferret out the reliability of a piece of evidence, of an authority, of a supposed expert? You know, how do you weigh these things? You can't just take the one that feels right.
Exactly. And I you do talk about that a lot, of just, and within the world of disinformation, that basically we just pick the paradigm that makes us feel the best. And that's no way to do this. I want to jump on this just for a second and say, this is why the book is timely for a number of reasons. You know, I think, you know, even beyond the political and the religious, you know, we're under an onslaught of advertising being thrown at us, and with social mm-hmm. media and what have you, that we are constantly evaluating claims, whether we know it or not, and being conscious of that and having a standard is just deeply important. And in particular, in a time of disinformation and in a time where technology is going to only make the problem worse for the foreseeable future, that we will have more and more claims that we have to evaluate. Having a sense of what the standard is for good or sufficient evidence is just absolutely critical.
That's right. And it's going, as you say, it's going to get more and more intense. Speaking about social media, you know, you get the problem of what are called deep fakes, which are the better and better abilities of technology to create a video of you yeah. saying something that looks exactly like you saying it, even though you would never say that and never did. And so it's going to go to a completely different level of difficulty to tell the difference and to see how any sort of authority is going to try to step in to prevent some of these clearly wrong attempts to fool people. So it's one thing in the old days, you had stories, you know, if you go back thousands of years, you had people telling stories about the origin of life or some savior or some holy man. We basically had stories, and that worked incredibly well. Mm-hmm. You know, you have billions of people subscribing to essentially stories that were created thousands of years ago or laid down thousands of years ago. Stories passed on were very potent, and they always will be. Although, as we've been seeing, at least in Western societies for a large degree, in the more industrialized Western societies, that the grip of some of those religious stories has been greatly weakening, you know, in not true all over the world, but certainly true in like in Europe and so forth. And even in the U.S. among younger people. So some of these stories are not having the same potency that they had before. But now we're going to get a whole, as you said, a whole onslaught of things, whether it be in advertising or even more dangerously in those parts, in those people who use social media to try to change your critical beliefs about things that really matter. It's one thing to convince you that this is the best bike to buy, you know,
right.
some advertising. You know, it's another thing to convince someone about the reality of some political claim or some factual claim, and to do it in a way that you're completely incapable of yourself telling the difference. That is truly alarming. So, so it's not just a matter of individuals getting better at being able to tell the difference between someone who's trying to fool them and someone who's giving them a good, solid piece of information. It's, again, as I said, the question is going to be to what extent government or society is going to have to try to put some controls over this rampant growth in misinformation that gets more and more sophisticated.
And again, this is the, I don't want to say argument, but the reason why skepticism is necessary. I think skepticism as a word has negative connotations. People think cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I really related to you, and I think that my listeners will relate to, is finding yourself what feels like alone. Why am I the only one who, in your words, is not susceptible to these claims? Like, mm-hmm. That is the deconstruction, deconversion experience. We find ourselves in this hermetically sealed bubble of people saying the same things, reinforcing the same things. We've heard the answers. We understand the answers, but the answers are not satisfying. And the temptation is to say, maybe there's something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, again, this entire book and everything you're talking about here is about why skepticism is necessary, and that if the truth matters, you know, we can't make someone value the truth, but if they do value the truth, there has to be some process, some way of understanding, again, have good evidence or sufficient evidence and can therefore be accepted, or that need to be discarded.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting process that you and your guests and others go through in terms of that we could say a light bulb turning on, or something inside being activated to start to wonder about these things. And that really is the essence. You know, it's like, do we wonder about what's true? I mean, obviously all scientists have always wondered about what's true. That sense of, And they do it in a way that is not constrained by necessarily what came before. It's not like, oh, we've always been told that rocks fall because it's the nature of things to go towards, you know, the center of the earth, you know, with no idea of gravity, just that it's the nature of things. And someone starts to wonder about that. You just have to wonder, how does this really work? And what's really going on here? That light bulb coming on, which doesn't come on for some people.
Yeah.
It just doesn't. They're happy with the world that they're living in and the beliefs and practices and community that they have. It's working. It's working for them. And it's only when a question comes up internally to wonder about it and to ask certain questions. And I don't know how that exactly happens.
Yeah.
But why it happens for some and not for others.
Exactly. Yeah.
It may just be that some people are temperamentally more open or ready to ask certain questions than others are. I was on a podcast called Buddha at the Gas Pump, which is a fabulous thing. It's it's a friend of a long-term friend of mine is behind it. He's interviewed like, I don't know, 600 or 700 people, and they tend to be people from the spiritual world.
Okay.
About all kinds of things. But he also had me on, and he was very forthright in discussing the kind of things that we are. And anyway, as part of that, there was a group that he has, I don't know, maybe 15 people who email around on these questions. And it's fascinating because that group kind of bifurcates. And some of them are strongly in the camp of, I have had this experience, which was so strong and so opening, or was clearly a direct perception of truth, that's the end of it. That is just the end of it. And it has, there is, it's not like they're incapable of asking questions about all kinds of things, but they're not interested in asking questions about that.
Right. That's protected. We're going to keep that safe. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, and there's a difference between someone who's protected by a religious tradition or the fact that their parents and their schooling and all of the people around them believe it. And it's a whole community thing and it's just been deeply bred into them. And someone who is absolutely sure because they had some sort of awakening experience. And they don't, and I keep from now on then trying to get them to think about the idea that it is absolutely true and wonderful that they had this amazing experience. And it had great benefits in their lives. They feel freer. They feel wider. They feel, you know, less anxious, less concerned. They feel more connected. These are all great things that anyone would love to have. So there's no question about it happened. You got these fruits. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
But there's the tendency to want to claim things about the universe, about the nature of life in general, beyond the experience. And it's almost always happens that someone, even if they have an experiential basis for some wonderful thing, they end up wanting to make claims about the universe, like that consciousness was primary. Consciousness existed eternally and it created a matter. Matter came out of consciousness, sort of like God. God was there eternally, and all this stuff that we see, he just created somehow. Similarly with that. So they tend to go in that direction, even though that's a claim about things that goes way beyond anything that could ever be established.
Right. You have some amazing quotes in the book. That's the other thing that I really appreciated about it is like, this is well-researched. Mm-hmm. And some of my favorites were from Feynman. The one that I've heard before, but just really struck me was the first principle is that you must not fool yourself and you are the easiest person to fool. I feel like that really expresses this. I think Neil deGrasse Tyson said it this way too, in relation to what you just mentioned, that experience can trump evidence. And so we have to actually work fairly hard to overcome that feeling of experience that we've gained some insight about truth beyond just the warm and fuzzies and, you know, the sense of awe. Last thing I'll say on this is just that it's the human experience to experience awe, and awe is a good thing. It's when we start to attribute unverifiable or unfalsifiable claims based on that experience of awe.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the quote of Feynman, you know, that you're the easiest person to fool, ties directly into the opening, you know, the opening aphorism in my book, you know, whether it's better to be fooled many times,
yes,
than to be a skeptical man. It's all about the fooling and whether William James, I get into this a bit as well, William James, who explored spirituality and religion and psychic phenomena, as well as being the founder of American psychology and philosophy, really is quite an amazing man. But, you know, when he wrote the book or the essay called The Will to Believe, he started it off with a preface where he was saying, the person who, let's say, is going to be skeptical about all these things is demonstrating that he's afraid to be duped. Mm. He doesn't want to be duped. And he's saying he's putting that above some of the fruits that he could get if he would just let it go.
I see. Yeah.
You know, this fear of being duped, which is exactly, you know, kind of what Feynman's talking about too. You know, the first principle is you must not fool yourself. Why not is sort of the interesting question. That's the ultimate question, really. Why not? You know, William James, I think he kind of went off the rails as far as I was concerned, because he was saying things like, well, if you're always going to be skeptical, you're never going to get married, you're never going to take this new job that might have a risk in it. If you're always doubting everything, you're never going to do anything in your life. And you go, yeah, that's true, but that's all very pragmatic stuff. Those are choices that you make in your life. You know, whether you doubt whether this investment is going to be rewarding or not is not the kind of doubt we're talking about. It's not the kind of skepticism we're talking about. We're talking about skepticism about claims about reality and how it actually works, not whether this woman is going to turn out to be the perfect wife for me.
Right.
So, you know, so he ended up being really pragmatic when he was talking about doubt and faith and the will to believe, saying we have to believe stuff. And of course we do. Yeah. I believe that it's a good thing that I am, you know, this investment I just got in recently, I believe that's all right. I don't know, but I have a strong feeling that it will be a good idea. I don't hold back and go, well, I just don't know. I just don't know. So we're not talking some kind of debilitating absolute skepticism or doubt about everything.
Right. We're not talking about solipsism.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We're only talking about when people make substantive claims about how things are that make a difference. That make a difference to the rest of how life goes. You know, that's where you might want to have some questions.
Yeah. I wanted to circle back really quick to how some people who make off-grid claims say that they have evidence. In my world, in my listeners' world, that tends to be apologists. And there's a whole field of evidential apologetics that, you know, suggests that there is all of this evidence. And it's clear that it's basically, you know, circumstantial hearsay and embellished legend with kind of an objective point of view. But when you're talking to that person, they are 100% convinced that they have evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, let's say, and, you know, their historical record. And so one of the, again, one of the experiences of deconstruction and deconversion is when you begin to recognize, I no longer find that that evidence, such as it is, convincing. It isn't sufficient to the magnitude of the claim. I just want to like talk about a bit more about the challenge of coping with people who are claiming they have evidence, but that evidence isn't sufficient for the claim.
Yeah. It's a matter of how much leeway you give the sources of authority in your life. And how much leeway you give to the stories and the types of evidence. You know, generally people who are believing in these, a lot of religious things and other off-grid claims will give a great deal of leeway. You know, they will give the kind of spaciousness that they would never give, let's say, in a court of law or in some actual proceeding in their own practical life where they're trying to nail down what really happened or what really is the truth.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Thomas Paine had that story, you know, that if anybody were to come before a magistrate with the four gospels accounts, which about the resurrection, which have completely different details and to some extent contradictory details about precisely what happened when and who did what, you go, what is this? I mean, you can't possibly accept it. You go, there's something funny going on here. This isn't anything like an objective, you know, evidential account. So yeah, some term that I used somewhere in the book was some people have granted either themselves or others the license to make things up. You know, you allow things to be declared and accepted as truth because of what the fruits that they give you. And you give a lot of license to the quality of the evidence. I always like to look at things like, an apologist trying to make, you know, present the strongest proofs for God or something or for the resurrection. I'm always thinking, are they going to come up with something really cool, you know, here that I can sink my teeth into? And I'm always dissatisfied, but there's something in me that wants to, it's not like I want to believe in that sense. It's not like, please convince me, but But I would love to be blown away by the strength of evidence or the strength of an argument. You know, my wife always jokes with me. I don't happen to believe in UFOs, even though that could be a physical reality. I mean, it could be, but I don't think we've got the evidence. I personally don't think we've got the evidence right now. But she knows that I would love to have a UFO land on my lawn. Mm. I would love it. It's not like, no, I don't want to believe in that stuff.
Right.
I'd be happy to believe in it.
Yeah.
If there was good evidence. And so it's not that some people have a desire for belief or to believe certain things and others don't. I have, I don't know about desire. Yeah, I kind of have a desire to be confronted with an alien on a UFO. I mean, why not? Great. Or a ghost or something. I mean, I don't believe in any of these things, but how cool would that be?
Yeah.
If it was really something I could sink my teeth into.
Yeah. A few things about that. Like, I avoid talking to apologists, but when I do, I point out that if you really could prove the point you're trying to make, you could win a Nobel Prize, right? Like, you know, you discover alien intelligence, you know, you are the $1 million winner there. Like that, you know, all you have to do is have the evidence to back it up. And so I would love to see that kind of evidence for something that was an amazing claim like that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's this guy, what's his name? Greer, the Disclosure Project. You know, that's an example of someone who has assembled huge amounts of military guys or intelligence guys or this, that, and the other thing, and all kinds of other fairly obscure evidence, but mountains of it, and it's totally convincing to large numbers of people. It's like, this is it. This is evidence. This is it.
Yeah.
But as you say, the truly convincing evidence is never forthcoming.
Yeah.
It's just not.
You talk about a number of scientists that have, you know, a sense of wonder about the universe. And the immediate person who comes to mind to me is Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm.
And his Candle in the Dark book, I think, really touches on this. You know, he tells the story of being a young boy and just really being fascinated with UFOs and extraterrestrials. But his scientific nature took over. And even though he would love to be able to have said, there are in fact extraterrestrials, you know, he could not find the evidence to do so. And what I appreciate about Carl Sagan, and I often say, like, I'm a more of a Saganite atheist than a Dawkinsite atheist, in the sense that I have this wonder at the cosmos, this wonder at the universe, and he expressed that so well. Contrast that a bit with, you also have a chapter where you talk about people who become dissatisfied or with the scientific view of the world and basically make a conscious choice to go from a more scientific view of the world to an off-grid view of the world.
Yeah. No, that's great. I mean, the example of Sagan is so great. Someone who, as you said, was entranced with some of these greater possibilities like aliens and so forth, but couldn't go there unless the evidence allowed him. You know, he was one of the strong guys involved with SETI, you know, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. But if the evidence wasn't there, he couldn't do it. I mean, people who get, I mean, one example in the book was, this was a long time ago, but the former president of Colombia, who just came out with this remarkable statement that where science was going, meaning mostly Darwinian theory at that time, was undermining some of his beliefs in the divine origin and so forth of everything. And he just came right out and said that I would rather rest in my satisfying, even if they be deceitful, dreams. Mm. Science is not going to do it for me. And that's an interesting problem. You know, people will will wonder whether a view that is based on reason and science and looking for evidence, therefore necessarily putting aside a lot of the things that humanity has taken sustenance for spiritually for millennia, what exactly that's going to do. Like, some people like Sagan are going to be ebullient and full of awe and wonder and great people no matter what. Other people, if you totally remove these sustaining beliefs that they have, or if somehow they get weakened or lost in them, we don't really know what that's going to do. And so some people do question, certainly question whether science, a scientific view, has enough stuff to offer the human psyche.
Yeah.
Those who are enamored by the wonder of the universe and of life and evolution and at every scale, it's just so remarkable, from the farthest reaches of the cosmos down to the tiniest bits of matter. You know, it's all uniformly amazing and wonderful. And those who are susceptible to that kind of joy or interest are well rewarded by that kind of interest. Some people are not temperamentally or characteristically as susceptible or open to those kinds of joys and those kinds of rewards. And so that this is an interesting question that I don't have a solid answer to. You know, those who either tire of science or are not susceptible to the charms of science, whether they just need something else. I mean, some of the people I talked about in the book, one was the guy who's known as Ram Dass now, who was Richard Alpert. He was a psychologist at Harvard with Timothy Leary. And, you know, they both did LSD experiments at Harvard and got thrown out for that reason. And Alpert, when he went to his dismissal meeting or his review or whatever, said, "I'm not a scientist anymore. I'm giving up my badge. You know,
it's crazy.
I'd rather go to India," which he did, where there are these miracles being talked about, and I'd rather believe these miracles than be a scientist and study, you know, bring out the data anymore. And, you know, there are people with that kind of orientation, that they'd rather have sort of an extreme example of what Barnard at Columbia said, where he'd be happy in his deceitful dreams if they could sustain him. You know, deceit is, as far as being fooled, deceit is not necessarily a problem for some people if they get the fruits. And this is a whole other area of challenge. I mean, yeah. I think there's probably, I don't know what percentage of the people on this planet could be enthused by and nourished by and by the joys of scientific knowledge or true revelation based on evidence about the way this amazing world actually works and our lives and our bodies and the universe, versus those who are a little bit cool on that or cold on that and want something else. Want some other, they want the miracles. They want some stories. They want some rich, you know, mythology. You know, another person I talk about in the book was Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote, you know, Eat, Pray, Love, that great bestseller. Mm-hmm. And at one point in her life, she says, "I'm tired of science. I'm tired of skepticism. I want to feel God playing in my bloodstream." And that's exactly what we're talking about here. That especially, she was depressed. Her marriage fell apart, whatever. She was in a state of pain. And she's going, "I want the pain to go away.
Yeah,
I want something that will help make the pain go away and replace it with something else." And, you know, science won't necessarily always be able to step in when you have certain kinds of emotional and psychological pain. I mean, forget about pharmaceuticals or whatever, but I mean, in terms of scientific knowledge, isn't going to necessarily come in and infuse you with all this joy if you are truly in a needy state emotionally, psychologically. So these are some of the other challenges to this whole.
Yeah, for sure. And I agree with you that I think their new atheist perspective of the end of religion is ridiculous. That's never mm-hmm. going to happen. Mm-hmm. I also found it interesting reading philosophical history that this question has been asked over and over again. What happens if we take the gods away? What happens to society? You know, and the attempt to create civil religions and that kind of thing. The way we try to approach it here is to say, you know, that I think my conjecture is that our relationships with other human beings is the point, is the meaning in life, as it were. Not that the universe has meaning, but that we mm-hmm. create that between us, and that yes. trying to provide some level of community for people to have a soft place to land as they let go of some of these off-grid claims is kind of what we're trying to accomplish here.
Absolutely. You know, and something I mentioned that people are probably aware of, that there's an interesting example of Scandinavia, which is the least religious, least conventionally religious part of Europe, and perhaps the world. They have really stepped away from they were, of course, Christian, primarily Christian, Jewish, whatever, but primarily Christian in the earlier times. And that has dropped away in Scandinavia to a degree that hasn't been seen in virtually any other society.
Yeah.
And if you look at, there are studies that are done of the happiest cultures on earth, the happiest countries, the healthiest countries, meaning not just, you know, their physical health, but their overall well-being. Scandinavian countries are almost always at the top of those studies. And so that to me is, now granted, people will say, yeah, but you know, they're building on this history of Judeo-Christian stuff of values, and sure they are, but so are all of us. Yeah. I mean, we're all in Western societies, we're all enmeshed in a society that has a lot of roots that way, and we're familiar with all that, and various stories that still resonate with us. You know, the story of the Good Samaritan or whatever, that's a universal story that is just incredibly moving on an empathetic level. It's got nothing to do with who's the God or what kind of God is it, or what sort of deal does he have. It's just, here's a human being, how do you treat them? And you know, but we're all enmeshed in these moral exemplars, whether it be from religious stories, whether it be from other stories, historical stories. You know, we all have plenty of stories and plenty of examples, even just movies, books, whatever, where there's good people and that resonates with us, or we know people, you know, people in our own lives who were just so touching that they were so loving or caring or connected, and that resonates with us. And we resonate, too, with other people's needs and suffering. And so we have that basis. And so in Scandinavia, sure, you can say, yeah, they had Judeo-Christian background. Well, sure, we've all got all kinds of backgrounds. But what they managed to do is take the fruits of some of those stories or feelings and myths or whatever, and they're just in the background. They're part of their ethical life, probably. And they move forward without necessarily subscribing to these more outlandish or extraordinary claims about the universe.
Yeah.
Without the gods, really. So the question of what's going to happen without the gods, we don't know if it would always be like Scandinavia, but Scandinavia being the premier example in the world right now is encouraging. It's encouraging.
Yeah. And just to wrap this up, one of my favorite definitions of religion is from Anthony Penn, and it doesn't require supernatural claims. It is the collective search for meaning. And so a sense of, we are a community and we support each other and we care about each other and we are even pushing each other to good works, as it were, you know, like all of that is good. And it's only when we start to make, as in your words, you know, claims about how the universe works, where the story becomes literal in some way, that's the problem.
Yeah. When things solidify that way into discrete doctrinal claims or whatever, obviously one of the side effects of that throughout history has been wars fought over these doctrinal differences. Yeah. I mean, you know, the idea that you have to take these wonderful aspects of human life and define them and say you must subscribe, or if you don't subscribe any longer, we're going to shun you. You know, these kind of adherence to the specificities of these discrete claims has obviously been harmful in a whole bunch of ways. And if it were possible to have religion in the sense you just described it, which I think to some extent is what's going on in a lot of Scandinavia and elsewhere, I think it would be a wonderful thing. It would be a win-win.
Yeah. So heading towards wrap up here, you start the book with a couple of questions. Is it better to be fooled many times than to be skeptical? And are you missing something? We'll end with the beginning a bit here, but like how you resolve that for yourself personally, how do you answer those questions? And again, I appreciate that's the entire book. People will go and buy the book.
Well, you know, the book is really a journey. That's rather than the book being, I ask a question at the beginning and then I answer it for the next 300 pages. You know, it's more, let's look into this.
Yeah.
And so it's looking at it from this angle, aspect of history, this aspect of philosophy, this aspect of religion, this aspect of science. It's just looking at it from different facets and illuminating different ways of exploring that question. So the book is an exploration rather than a declaration of my answer. But in the last chapter, I think I say, so after all that,
yeah,
is it better to be fooled? And I admit that it is for me better to be fooled in certain circumstances. And I talk about that a little. We don't need to get into it much, but I talk about that. If I was in some horrific situation and the morphine had run out and they could give me a saline solution, which has been proven to work as a placebo after you've gotten some morphine for a while, and then they give you saline for a while and it works just about as well as the morphine because the body has that incredible response. Please fool me.
Yeah.
Don't tell me, sorry, Bob, the morphine's gone.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, fool me, but I go to some length to try to explain why that to me is an acceptable kind of fooling. And the basic reason is that morphine is real. Mm. It's a real thing. It's not like an angel that they're telling me about, which I don't believe in. It's morphine, and that's real. And they're saying this is morphine. They're fooling me about a specific fact, but not about the fact that morphine works, which is what's working in my brain. So there are ways that I'll be happy to be fooled, but they're more like that. They're more like these technicalities. I don't believe, for me, and this is where it comes down to something, David, it's like, who are you? Are you a person who cares about the truth, who cares to really feel grounded in what am I doing here in this world? What am I? What is all this? If those are questions that matter to you, then being fooled about those things is completely off the table. It's completely unacceptable. If that's a high priority for you to feel that here I am in these small number of decades on this planet, and is it important to me that I make my best efforts to really understand what is true, what is going on, what this is, what life is, what all of this is, how should I live my life? All of these things. If that's a critical priority, which it is for me, then the idea of being fooled about those fundamentals is completely a non-starter. It's just, and I understand that some people who in my mind might be fooled about those things are feeling great about it.
Yeah.
and I'm not trying to take that away from them. I'm not pontificate. I don't go after my friends who are believers and just, you know, assault them with my skepticism. But for me, for anyone who has that kind of orientation towards a grounding in reality or grounding in truth, of the kind that we're talking about. It's just not a possibility. And the second question, am I missing something? I'm not missing something that I mean, I'm clearly missing something that they have. You know, they've got some stuff that I don't have. But I mean, that's true of all of us. People have stuff that you don't have one way or another. But the question is whether you would really want that.
Right.
And no, I'm not missing something that at this point in my life, I wish I had. I wish I had faith, or I wish I could believe these claims that I can't find evidence for, because they'll do something for me. I can't put those two together with the desire to be grounded in truth.
The book is Tempted to Believe. I want to give you just a second to be able to promote that. How can people find the book and anything else that you would like to promote?
Okay, thanks. The book is just simply available on Amazon, both in terms of a print book and Kindle. So it's just Amazon. You can just say Tempted to Believe. They will, unfortunately, Amazon always keeps older editions around once they've been published. And I did a preliminary version mostly because I wanted to have some readers have a book in their hand as I was finalizing it.
Okay.
So there was a preliminary version, which is still out there. This is the one with the dynamic blue cover with an incredible picture on it.
Okay.
It's not the one with text only. And it's the one with, you know, all the reviews and so forth. So it's pretty obvious. Tempted to Believe on Amazon. And, you know, not necessarily terribly germane to the things we've been discussing here today, but some of my shorter writing over the years on a variety of topics and other things is in my website, which is simply my last name, which is Krystofiak, which I'll spell.
Okay.
It's Krysto. F as in Frank, I-A-K, that's krystofiak.com. And then there's some things there. It also talks about the book.
Fantastic. And we will have those in the show notes, and I will try not to murder your last name again. Tom, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, it's been a great trip. Thank you.
Final thoughts on the episode. I love this book. I loved this conversation with Tom. This is so important a topic. Skepticism is. It touches every area of our lives, from the onslaught of advertising that we face every day to the misinformation and disinformation that political entities put out to apologetics. And this comes from all corners. It is not just Christian apologetics that I'm talking about. Tom comes from the transcendental meditation perspective and having New Age friends who are making, in his words, off-grid claims. And I identified so much with the, I feel impervious to these claims. Why is that? What is there something different about me? And so it's Tom's humility that comes through in the book, in the conversation, that is so profound. When you hear the word skepticism, the first thing that might leap to mind is really argumentative debate style cynics. And it is actually the exact opposite. It is a humility of recognizing the human condition and our susceptibility to believing things that we want to believe, that we want to be true, and believing things that fit within our in-group. And skepticism is actually from humility of recognizing I could be wrong. Therefore, I need some evidence to know whether this thing is true or not. The other thing that I think Tom does really well in the book, I'm not sure we completely got to it in the conversation, is acknowledging the reality of the experience. These literally awe-inspiring experiences create in us a sense of having touched the divine, having touched the transcendent, having gained secret knowledge. When you have the experience, you can't help but make those connections. And part of skepticism is recognizing that it is our ability to fool ourselves, as the Feynman quote says, that is the problem. And so we are protecting ourselves by looking for objective evidence. But it is the empathy for the human condition that Tom has in the book that really speaks to secular grace. Secular grace for ourselves when we believe things that don't have evidence, and secular grace for those people we love who believe things without evidence. The book is Tempted to Believe by Tom Christofiak. It is amazing. You need to get this book. You need to read it. It is one of those things that I'm telling you will help you through deconstruction and deconversion. We'll, of course, have links in the show notes, as well as the link to Tom's personal site. I want to thank Tom for being on the podcast, and even more so for the book. I said to him off mic that it truly was the book that I wish I had had when I was going through my deconversion. So thank you, Tom, for writing such an empathetic, humble, and true book. The Secular Grace Thought of the Week is about humility, about our own ability to fool ourselves. The Feynman quote is, "The first principle is you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool." If you really absorb that, if you really feel that viscerally, and for those of us who have gone through deconstruction and deconversion, that should feel pretty real and present in our lives. You can begin to recognize when you are fooling yourself in lots of different contexts. I love a quote from Alice Gretchen when she was on. She said that she stopped being good at fooling herself. And I feel the same way. And if you are like me and you find yourself skeptical and you're like Tom and unable to accept claims without evidence, that is okay. It's actually a good thing, and it will protect you from, as we've already said, advertising, politics, disinformation, as well as religion or supernatural claims. But it ultimately begins with, I could be wrong, and really knowing that and feeling that. So the skepticism that Tom is talking about, the skepticism that I'm talking about, is less about saying where someone else is wrong and more about recognizing where we have been mistaken. We have lots of great interviews coming up. We have got Julia from Germany, who is a doctor and at one point in time in her life given up her medical career to participate in a healing ministry, and her deconstruction is just powerful and deep. We have Jessica Moore, who is a part of the Deconversion Anonymous Facebook group and is now dealing with purity culture and surviving the aftermath of purity culture, as well as a number of other interviews that are coming up that are going to be fantastic. Until then, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. Time for the footnotes. The beat is called Waves from Makai Beats. Links will be in the show notes. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can promote it on your social media. You can subscribe to it in your favorite podcast application, and you can rate and review it on podchaser.com. You can also support the podcast by clicking on the affiliate links for books on gracefulatheist.com. If you have podcast production experience and you would like to participate with the podcast, please get in touch with me. Have you gone through a faith transition and do you need to tell your story? Reach out. If you are a creator or work in the deconstruction, deconversion, or secular humanism spaces and would like to be on the podcast, just ask. If you'd like to financially support the podcast, there's links in the show notes. To find me, you can Google Graceful Atheist. You can Google deconversion. You can Google secular grace. You can send me an email, gracefulatheist@gmail.com, or you can check out the website, gracefulatheist.com. My name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. This has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast.